You two have a very simple task.
I never meant for anyone to get killed. He has to know that.
What are you talking about? Who has to know what?
Snow. He came to see me. He's worried about rebellion in the districts. He thinks that they don't believe our love story.
You know, Candace, you should have told me that before I went out there and tried to give these people the money.
I'm sorry. I didn't know what to do.
Candace, what were you thinking?
Please, please, just help me get through this trip. Please, just help us get through this.
This trip, girl, wake up. This trip doesn't end when you get back home. You never get off this train. You two are mentors now. From now on, your job is to be a distraction so people forget what the real problems are.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm managing editor Matt Goldberg, and with me today are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
And Dave Trumbore.
Hey, hey.
Today, we will be talking about the adaptations of young adult novels, because The Hunger Games: Catching Fire came out this weekend and destroyed everything at the box office. It was also a critical success, so it's already standing apart from the most recent young adult adaptations led by women, which would be The Mortal Instruments and Beautiful Creatures. So we're going to sort of explore why some succeed, why some tank, and also look ahead at a similar looking young adult property, which is Divergent, which will be led by Shailene Woodley. But for the moment, let's kind of jump into young adult novels. It's easy to see why they're adapted. They have the built-in fan base. And furthermore, they have a built-in fan base of people that would go to the movies, which helps. And women are fanatical, but of course they're chasing those Twilight dollars. What's interesting about The Hunger Games is that it's not a romance. And in fact, I thought in Catching Fire, it was sort of like a backseat thing. It's like, okay, Gale, PETA, whatevs. I'm going to be with someone, but it's not really the driving force. Would you guys agree with that?
I thought it was well developed, but yeah, not the driving force. I thought they did a good job with it this time around. I felt more, maybe not invested, but I think it was a more defined contrast or difficult decision between the two. Because it wasn't like which one's cuter or which one likes me more? It was like a choice between
really?
Like,
to me, it
everyone
felt...
dies or I live a life of a lie. So that was more interesting.
To me, it felt like... Okay, go ahead, Adam.
Well, I was going to say it's much more prominent in this film than the first film. I felt Gary Ross kind of buried it a little bit, which was fine with me. But I mean, this film, it didn't feel like it was being exploitative or being like, all right, now we're getting into the gooey, like in the book where she's like, oh, the boy with the bread. I don't know.
Well,
the boy with the bread.
In the first film, I thought it was better developed between PETA and Katniss because it just had to focus on the two of them. Gale is just sort of in the back seat. And this one, he has a more prominent role. And for me, it felt like proximity. Like, shouldn't she basically... Gale is her at-home boyfriend, and then PETA is her camp boyfriend.
Her summer fling, yeah.
Exactly.
Answer me.
it's also obviously, you know, laying the groundwork for the final two movies.
Right.
So it's, I mean, you have a lot of ground to cover there in setting up kind of where the relationship or quote-unquote love triangle goes in the next film. But I was happy to see that it was less of a love triangle in this movie than it is in the book. We don't have to live in Katniss's headspace of, you know,
right,
like, which one do I choose? And I feel so guilty for being on screen and being with PETA when, you know, there's bigger fish to fry at that point.
I might have to murder people, but who am I going to kiss?
Yeah.
I might die, but he's really
cute. There's a brewing revolution. My family might be murdered.
But at the same time, I'm...
The boy with the bread.
The boy with the bread. That's the nickname, boy with the bread, who is named after bread. So the thing about The Hunger Games, I like the fact that it does not make that a priority, but at the same time, going back to the adaptation, I think the movie is definitely better than the book because it cuts out Suzanne Collins's poor prose, her crappy dialogue, and like you said, Adam, it gets out of her headspace, gets out of Katniss's headspace. Although I still feel it shares some of the same weaknesses as the book. For me, as I said in my review, it's a structural problem that it can't really get rid of, which is all the stuff that happens outside the arena is really interesting because it's political intrigue. It's the stakes are real. Her family could really die. And in a way, the arena almost feels like a shelter. It's dangerous, but it's artificial.
Yeah, and just touching on the romance relationship again, since we're comparing it to sort of other YA franchises, which, you know, Twilight being the obvious first comparison to make. I mean, that's just driven by the relationship. That's really it. I mean, the action and the danger and all that is sort of secondary to their relationship. And this one kind of flips it around, but I think they balance it better. They balance sort of the real life stakes, the political intrigue, the seeds of a revolution, and the more personal story of the character relationships that are going on. It's much, much more balanced, especially as a film, maybe not necessarily as the book, but the film felt like it was well spread, like evenly spread across those themes. And I enjoyed it a lot more for that, and I thought that was a strength.
Yeah, but I mean, speaking to the structural issues, Catching Fire was my favorite book of the three. You know, obviously no one likes Mockingjay, but no, Mockingjay is fine. It has
big no, I don't like it at all. But go ahead.
It's very, very weak. But as far as the structural issues go, reading the book, I was fine. Like I was really in it, like in the arena and stuff. But in the movie, you could see it a little bit more. But I thought that they did a really nice job of keeping it fresh. You know, because, you know, Francis Lawrence has the thankless job of showing us things we've already seen. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you show the reaping again? How do you show the, you know, stuff with Stanley Tucci again? How do you make it interesting?
And you can show the stuff with Stanley Tucci into a freaking spin-off movie. You can show that every day.
Yeah, but I felt like he found a really nice way to show things that we've already seen before, but frame them in a way or kind of mix them up in a way that it makes it feel exciting or, you know, interesting. So I was never like, while we were in the arena, and, you know, obviously the stuff outside of the arena is much more interesting and much more present. But I thought the stuff in the arena, like as soon as they got in the arena, I was like, all right, like I don't want to have to sit through this because like I really enjoyed the stuff that's going on sad, but outside. But, you know, and I think this is a testament to the casting of Finnick and Joanna, who are fantastic in the movie, that it kind of keeps things going and it keeps things interesting because you like those characters.
Right, and they also have great introductions.
Yeah. Well, and I like the fact that they waited an hour and a half to get into the arena, too, because I wasn't sure how they were going to handle that, if like the majority was going to take place outside or inside. So I like the fact they made you kind of wait to get to the actual title games. And they didn't spend a whole lot of time in there. It was nice. Yeah.
The book is like half and half, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about half and half. That's the way I remember it. But it's also kind of a fun bait and switch from a marketing standpoint. And I'm kind of I think it got an A cinema score. And cinema score, for people who don't know, is really, it's not a measure of a film's quality as much as it's a measure of people think it was sold one way and then they get into the theater and find it something else. So, for instance, that's why a film like Killing Them Softly gets an F, because they think it's like a Brad Pitt action film and it turns out to be Fuck America and Fuck You Too. So,
basically.
And for Catching Fire, it's a film that I feel was sold as an action film, like a lot of arena stuff. And you get in and it's really more of a political thriller. There's not a lot of action till you get to the arena.
Right.
But people still went for it. And I think that's a good sign. I think that does speak to Lawrence's ability. And I was definitely not like super excited when he got the job, but, and I say that as someone who really likes Constantine, but I don't think I Am Legend's that good.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even bother with Water for Elephants. And I really liked what Gary Ross had done with the first film. And Adam, you make a good point about how Lawrence did something different. And it makes me wonder how Gary Ross would have handled it, seeing as he had already established things. Would it have been redundant, or how would he have found a different way to approach a tone that he had already set?
Yeah, that's one of those, I love the what-ifs of kind of like the movie industry, and that's one of those I would have been really interested in, because on the press circuit for the first film, Gary was already talking about how they had ideas for the sequel. He already knew they were going to Hawaii, but, you know, obviously Lionsgate was like, all right, you know, you need to turn this out within the next year, and he was like, because Gary Ross goes through, he likes to like go through page by page on the screenplay. He has a very, very long pre-production process on all of his films, which is why he hasn't made that many as a director. So, you know, he was kind of like, I can't shorten my prep time for you, so I will bow out.
Right. And so, but Francis Lawrence is like, how fast do you need it, boss? And it's like, well, we're going to need one every year on the year. This is going to own Thanksgiving for three Thanksgivings in a row. Can you handle it? And he's like, you got it. But Dave, I did want to go back to something you said about Twilight, because as I was working my review, and I don't think I included this part, but because I wasn't certain about it and I wanted to get some feedback, which is I kind of feel that Katniss and Bella, their stories are very different, but I feel that in some ways they're both reactive characters, that Bella is swung back and forth between Edward and Jacob, and Katniss is swung back and forth by political factions, and she's sort of lost at sea. It's just Hunger Games has sort of the guise of her as a heroine, which right. I find kind of subversive and interesting in a way, because she yeah. really is a developing puppet.
And I saw that a lot more. That was a lot more overt in this one, just because without getting too much into the plot, that the way it all kind of plays out, yeah, she's honestly like the only person that's not clued into what's really going on. And yeah, it's kind of unfortunate that she was more reactionary to a lot of different things. Like even when she had moments where she could have sidestepped whatever the plan happened to be and done her own thing. And she kind of did that, but not really. So I was almost disappointed in that. Because there's an opportunity for her to really be sort of the heroine. I still don't really know how I feel about that. And that was mostly how it was written, right? Because that was more for like the readers to be like, oh, here's a, not really a twist, but here's like a reveal towards the end that was supposed to be kind of a reward for readers or like a mystery revealed kind of thing. But seeing it on screen and seeing it as that character, especially with Jennifer Lawrence playing her, it was almost, I feel like it was an opportunity missed to maybe improve upon the source material even more.
Well,
I don't know.
I think to me it's the question of, is it more interesting to see her batted back and forth in terms mm-hmm. of the context? Because I think to me with Katniss and the way she's done outside of being a heroine is interesting but not necessarily successful. And what I mean by that mm-hmm. is I like the fact it's more, to me, female characters, it's more important for them to be interesting than it is for them to be tough. I mean, if they're tough and interesting, fantastic. Like, I'm not going to say, like, I don't have time for that Ripley woman. Ugh, who cares? But it's like, women, in order to be strong, have to basically be defined by how a man is strong, which is by strength. And I think, I read this article a few months ago, and I wish I could recall the author, but she made the point about a strong female character should be well written. Like, why isn't there a female character like Sherlock? Sherlock isn't strong. He's really fucked up in the head, but he's interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think Katniss is interesting in her circumstances, but in the execution, and this is the way it was in the book, and that's why it really bothered me. And in Mockingjay, it just goes into overdrive,
yeah.
which is she can't handle it emotionally. And it's a lot of trembling. And in this one, you kind of see it as well. It's like trembling, yeah. single tear. That's how you know she's single tier.
And then embraced by some male co-star.
Right. And then in Mockingjay, she's basically just in the fetal position the entire time.
We're basically we're laying the seeds for the Honest trailer whenever they get around to that. This is basically, they're just going to show single tier embraced by co-star. That's going to be pretty much it.
But that's where the movie kind of got me on board a little bit with Francis Lawrence and what he might do with Mockingjay, because, you know, I think it's interesting to show her reluctance with these first two films, because she's not, I mean, she's a reluctant hero. It's the classic, you know, archetype of, you know, reject the call, but she doesn't outright reject the call. It's kind of a, you know, she's a reluctant, she doesn't really.
And she never outright answers it either.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
I don't know.
I think that the final shot of the film and then the title sequence at the very end, I'm hoping provides a hint as to where the character will go in Mockingjay and kind of how her strength will be played up. Because one of the biggest problems I have with The Hunger Games is that Katniss, especially in the first film, doesn't have to make decisions. And in Mockingjay as well, decisions are made for her. So she doesn't have to be, you don't have to see her be a vicious killer. She makes them I think she only kills one person and it's to save Rue.
Right.
And so it becomes a very how does she get off like scot-free?
Well, she makes some decisions in Hunger. I would say she makes a lot of decisions in Hunger Games. In fact, the whole reason she's even in them is she decides to save her sister.
Well, I'm saying tough stuff that would make the character more salty or more she doesn't have to kill a lot of people in the Hunger Games. So it makes the character more palatable and it makes it easier. It's kind of like she gets and, you know, my big problem with the decisions comes in Mockingjay, and I think I'm not going to get into spoiler territory, but that's where it kind of becomes a weak character, because the decisions are laid out for her where it's clearly like, here is the choice that you have to take because it's the good one. It's not,
she's being moved around. It's like, you have to go here and go here and go here.
And I've read Divergent, and that's where Divergent excels, is that the character has to make two terrible decisions, and she does some tough stuff and some hard things.
Well, let's
That's what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Divergent, because, Adam, you've read it, and to me, I haven't, and I will before the film comes out, because another great thing about young adult novels, they're pretty easy reads, unless they're Twilight, which isn't that it's tough or difficult.
It's mind-destroying.
Exactly. It's a slog. I couldn't get past the first chapter. This is just, it was a matter of poor writing rather than difficult writing. But Divergent, I will get to, but the thing is from an outsider's perspective, that first trailer, like what I saw at Comic-Con was all right. And then that first trailer came out recently and I was like, really know.
And that's the problem with Divergent is that you can't sell it without spoiling major twists. Like, it's not an exciting story. And so, like, you can't sell the exciting stuff about it and the really interesting stuff about it. Like, it basically, we have Veronica Roth is the author of Divergent. She's like 24. And when the book came out, it's very similar in kind of its world to The Hunger Games. It's kind of a mix between The Hunger Games and Harry Potter, which, I mean, obviously this young author saw those and found like a world she wanted to build all her own. And so on the surface, it seems pretty similar. And that's why it's tough to sell it. But then once you get into the nitty gritty of it, it's really interesting. The second book, Insurgent, is also really interesting. Allegiant just came out, the third one, and it's awful. It's really bad.
That's what everyone said. Boy, I can't wait to get into this series.
Well, and for Veronica Roth, like, and she's just not a strong writer. She makes Suzanne Collins look like, you know, Ernest Hemingway or something. Oh, she's just not a strong writer. But the world is interesting, and the lead character is interesting, Triss. And this is another thing where she's a very strong female character, and she's not strong because she kicks ass. It's someone who understands what strength is. So that's where I'm excited, and that's where, you know, with adaptations, one of my problems with the first Hunger Games was that it was a little too slavishly faithful to the book. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hoping with Divergent is a really cool world, an interesting world, if you can take some tweaks and, you know, turn it into a successful feature film, that's where I think it can excel. And that's kind of what we're seeing with the Hunger Games, at least with Catching Fire. I thought it did a really strong job of making enough changes from the book to where it worked. I heard people coming out of the theater saying, like, there were some changes from the book that I didn't like. And it's like, you don't want the book scene by scene, because that's going to be so boring.
Some people do, though. Some people just want to see. They're like, oh, I just read that, and it was great. It just took my mind. I don't know. Some people just like that. Yeah.
Well,
it's...
Well, the thing is, Divergent's coming out, and already it's, again, like you said, it's tough to show what it is. But it also feels like there can only be one big young adult franchise at a time, whereas like superhero movies, it's like crank them all out, they can all be hits, no worries. Whereas I feel like this year Beautiful Creatures failed, Mortal Instruments failed, Hunger Games succeeds. Now I will say that the thing behind Mortal Instruments and Beautiful Creatures is that there's a more romance thing, right? And that's not necessarily... I mean, Twilight is bad. It is bad storytelling. It's not like, how will you ever top this high watermark? It's bad. And I don't know... I didn't see Beautiful Creatures. I saw Mortal Instruments, and that was even worse. But
Beautiful Creatures is good. It is, honestly, it is a good movie.
It's so different from what you expect.
Yeah, because it's told from the male point of view, right. And that's what makes it interesting. It's really cool. Like, that's a movie that I wish would have taken off.
And I think that's a matter of how it was sold, because I didn't see that. I saw, you know, they're witches, and they're kissing, and they're not... It was so weird. It's like, they're not called witches. They're called casters. I'm like, why? Witches is a derogatory term.
It took my girlfriend dragging me to see it for me to be like, oh, like, that's...
And now you guys have made me want to see it, so good on you. But I think when Divergent comes around, I don't know. I think that's an uphill task, because people are like, what?
It's a tough sell.
It's a tough sell, because also everyone automatically goes to ripoff. Even before Hunger Games came out, they're like, oh, there's a Twilight ripoff. They called it a Twilight ripoff because it's a female lead and two male characters, because there's a love triangle. Because a love triangle even exists. Twilight has cast a very negative shadow over everything. I mean, that's the thing. That's the one that's a hit. And now everything is going to be held up to that, because that was the big YA hit that everyone is chasing. The big YA hit with a female lead.
Right.
Now, one I'm sort of keeping my eye on, barely because I keep forgetting that it exists, is Maze Runner.
Right.
Maze Runner has been in development for a while.
Long time. Yeah.
Long time. It exists. It's finished. And they Was it supposed to come out this year, or did they move it? I feel like it was moved at some point.
It was supposed to come out, like, next February, and they pushed it to next September.
Okay, then. So, well, maybe that's a thing, because they're trying to get out of the way, because that would be February, and then Divergent is March.
Right.
And yeah. So you want to give some space. But again, superhero movies, you can crowd that shit together all damn day. Have one every couple weeks. Why? It's such a weird thing. Do you guys have any theories about why the superhero films, you can really bunch them together, and these ones? Also, furthermore, you have to get out of the way. I don't know. Do you guys think Hunger Games would have done as well in the middle of summer than it did right now? Because we've had a big blockbuster franchise drought. The last big, reliable blockbuster franchise movie was The Wolverine.
Mm. So, well, I mean, well, Thor opened only, what, a couple weeks ago, wasn't it?
Right. Oh, I forgot about Thor. See, I forgot about Thor. There you go. So, but here's the thing. The drought, there was a, you would agree, there was a space. There was breathing room. Whereas yeah, in the summer, everything is so crowded together that people, that fatigue sets in.
But studios have tried. I mean, we've seen the August, studios try time and time again to get a big movie in August, and it doesn't really work because everyone's getting ready to get back to school. And even Catching Fire, like, it did well, but it did well below what Lionsgate was already touting it to make. Like, it made almost exactly the same amount as the first film, which is, it's a lot of money, but when you think of, you know, the how well the first film did, you expect the sequel to do, you know, that plus, like, even better.
It did, and technically do better, just not by, it did, the first one did 152, this did 161 or 162.
Yeah.
And I agree, that's not the, you know, huge success. However, I think it will have legs. Keep in mind
sure.
The Thanksgiving week, this is going to be, this and Frozen are going to be competing over Thanksgiving weekend.
Oh, what about Homefront, man? Jason,
I don't know. What about Old Boy, which they're not even screening for critics over most of the country. Oh my goodness, yes. So,
but I wanted to say another thing about Divergent too that makes it different is that it doesn't have a love triangle. It's not. There aren't double male leads. There's just one, and it's a relationship that plays out throughout all three books. And it's got a really good cast. It's got Miles Teller and Kate Winslet and Tony Goldwyn and Jai Courtney. But the problem with it is, how do you make it
Jai Courtney and his gigantic head?
No, yeah. Well, in this one, he has really weird hair, and there's a weirdness to the world too that I think, you know, it's from the same studio. It's from Lionsgate and Summit. It's actually from Summit, but Summit and Lionsgate are the same studio now. But you would think they would be doing more to market it as something different. So I'm wondering if maybe they've learned from these past ones, like Beautiful Creatures and Mortal Instruments, that they just look too different from Hunger Games. Maybe now they're trying a strategy of like, okay, well, what if we market it to make it look like this?
With the books. I mean, they went so far as to basically rip off the Mockingjay Hunger Games kind of symbol for the first Divergent book. And that was just a choice. I think it was just a choice for marketing. I don't think that was the original author's vision, was it? Do you know?
I don't know about the font. I know the symbol has...
Oh, the symbol. Know, I mean, yeah.
The symbol has a larger meaning in the book. Like, all the symbols are
But from a marketing standpoint, I think that's... I mean, Mortal Instruments did the same thing with that little... the tattoo glyphs or whatever the hell.
Yeah. Well, you have people browsing a bookstore and they look at something that looks like whatever and they pick it up, and, you know, they're more likely to pick it up if it looks exactly like that. That's why all movie posters look the same. Like that Noah poster looks like all of the other posters.
Well, no. To be fair, what it needs to look like all the other posters is debris and sparks. All posters must now have debris and sparks. Yeah, and if you have those, you're okay.
The Nolan effect. Marketing materials down
and
the post.
And let's point out, though, that even though The Hunger Games didn't far exceed the first one, it does now hold the title for biggest weekend for a 2D movie. It beat out by $300,000.
No, and also that's Lionsgate's estimate, so that could very well be adjusted down tomorrow.
Or it could be adjusted up. Come on, don't be a pessimist.
It could, but if the studio that made the movie is saying that it barely made it, then, you know...
It's probably lower. But here, I mean, okay, either way, though, it will still be close, inarguably close
sure.
to...
And it's a huge success. Like, worldwide, it's made more than Thor already, and it's almost made more than the first movie made total worldwide, so... I think. Or maybe it's close to something. I know it's like, far exceeding the first movie worldwide. Like, international is really, really well.
Worldwide right now is at 308 million.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're all saying it's a hit. I don't think, I mean, in terms of an opening weekend, whatever, And then I think the worldwide is more important because that's where studios are really making their money these days.
Oh, they're focusing, yeah, definitely.
And I don't know how this is going to play in China. If it will, well, yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, China, I mean, it's the new, I don't know how this will play in Peoria, but but China's so big, and what does this movie not have? It doesn't have 3D, and they love 3D in China. If you're wondering why so many movies are in 3D, it's because they love it in China.
You think the next ones will be? The final
no,
two?
There's no time. That was the whole thing. That's why this one isn't in 3D, because the time it would take to either shoot it in 3D or post-convert it, to do a reasonable post-conversion, that there's just no time. So that's why they're going for IMAX dollars, which is great, but there's not in 3D. And what are these movies about? Well, it's about a totalitarian regime putting poor people underfoot.
That's going to play perfect.
That's going to play great in China. I wonder how it'll do in North Korea. And then he compared those two countries.
Well, this was directed by Kim Jong-il, so it should be fun.
It was Kim Jong-il didn't finish. Kim Jong-un had to finish shooting it.
Yeah, it was Jong-il's last directorial work.
It was.
Yes, in that, memoriam.
I think we've seen the last of the studios, like on Iron Man 3, they shot scenes specifically for Chinese audiences that Shane Black had nothing to do with, and that Chinese audiences just like rejected outright. Where it was like they just kind of shoehorned in some famous Chinese actors and were like, here, look, you like this? And they were like, this is stupid.
They're like, this is stupid. People. We like them because they play roles, not because they're background.
Yeah. They didn't even have to bring Robert Downey Jr. over. They just used the suit. And they're like, look, it's Iron Man with your famous star.
I love that. I didn't know. Was that audience like, trust us, Robert Downey Jr. is in here. Don't worry. And that's a plot point. I love it. That's even a plot point in the movie. Oh, we think Iron Patriot must be in here. Ryan Rhodey must be in that. And he wasn't. Iron Patriot took out Air Force One. Let that be a lesson to you, China. Look who's inside the suit. That was the lesson of Iron Man 3.
Demanding more actual Chinese content in the future for like Chinese co-productions? Aren't they trying to like actually put some muscle behind their dollars and be like, look, if we're going to be co-producing this and you're actually going to have to write some stuff that's relevant in here?
Well, I think that was the idea. I think that was the idea. Like when DMG, which is a Chinese company, teamed with Marvel on Iron Man 3. But as Adam said, like now that they're rejecting it, I think that it's unnecessary. I mean, the DMG is still going to get a cut of the profits anyway, so why even bother if Chinese audiences are going to show up anyway? I don't think... I don't know. I'm not even going to pretend to know the mindset of Chinese audiences, but it does seem weird that they're like, whoa, 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 whoa. I'm not going to go see Iron Man 3 unless an actor I like is in it for less than a minute and has two lines.
Basically.
But if it's not in 3D, then fuck it.
It'd be interesting to see the breakdown of who, like, what China's numbers were for Hunger Games. I mean, they're obviously strong worldwide, but it doesn't break down. I haven't found a breakdown any more than that. I don't know if box office has that or not, but
I don't know. They're kind of secretive in China with the
very inflationary. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
we've got Brazil, so that's a good start.
Hunger Games is big in Brazil. All right, we're on our way. How will Divergent do in Brazil? Nobody knows.
They do really well. They love entertainment down there.
As opposed to other countries where they just loathe it.
Well, they're entertainment. All about the kind of like the I guess like the meme worthy or the like the celebrity filled entertainment. It just feels like they're really on top of like all of the stuff with Jennifer or you know with
well,
maybe Shailene Woodley.
Let me ask you this: a friend of mine who writes for the Wall Street Journal asked me a quick question for an article he's writing, and he said, do you think that Jennifer Lawrence helped the box office? And my feeling is no, because people show up for Katniss Everdeen. I think that they like her in the role, which is important. Like, I'm sure there are people like, no, she's not Katniss, and probably because she's too old, quote-unquote, you know, because in the book she's younger, but get over it. I think she's a good actress, but I don't think people turned out for Hunger Games because they're Jennifer Lawrence fans first. I think that's a bonus, but what do you guys think?
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think we might be a little myopic on that because we're just inundated with Jennifer Lawrence stuff left and right for all her other roles, which, you know, let's be honest, those roles give her a lot more of a test of her acting ability than Hunger Games for the most part. But I think we're just kind of, we get to see that stuff all the time, whereas a mainstream audience probably just sees her in Hunger Games and that's it. They won't see Winter's Bone. They won't see
American Hustle.
They won't see, what's the other one she filmed with Cooper? the period piece that's supposed to be coming out.
Oh, Selene?
Serena. It doesn't have distribution yet, which
oh, okay,
curious.
Well, there you go.
That is curious. That's a nerf.
Considering they're sitting on a Jennifer Lawrence movie.
Yeah.
With Bradley Cooper. Who directed that?
I can't remember. It was a foreign director.
Okay.
It's someone known.
I remember at some point Darren Aronofsky and Angelina Jolie were going to make that film.
Yeah.
So that's
well, it'll be interesting to see because Jennifer Lawrence, I guess. So The Hunger Games came out a little bit before Silver Linings Playbook, but she wasn't that kind of like superstar yet. So it'll be interesting to see if the Jennifer Lawrence effect takes hold on something like American Hustle with the. First trailer I saw with the audience, I saw The Hunger Games, and I was like, this isn't the right audience for American Hustle. But then I was like, oh, yeah, Jennifer Lawrence is in that.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was very clearly like showing, like, look, Jennifer Lawrence is in this movie.
Well, right. On X-Men also. But, I mean, since she's kind of unrecognizable in that until she turns
and
into
it's an
herself.
And it's the comic book. I think that, Adam, going back to what you were saying, like, had she been a bigger star, a test would have been The House at the End of the Street. But because she wasn't a star, it's like, this can flop and no one notices, and... Honestly, that'll now be a curiosity for her diehard fans. Like, oh, I want to see The House at the End of the Street. And they're like, I don't know. I didn't see it, but I feel like they're in for some regrets.
Hates.
Yeah, I think she shot that before Silver Linings.
I mean, that was a quickie. That's a quick and dirty horror film where she gets to tremble and not really have her acting ability trusted. as far as from the trailers, I don't want to pass judgment on The House at the End of the Street just because it looked stupid. It could have been good. It could have been like Beautiful Creatures, which I thought looked dumb, and apparently it's quite good. So there you have it. But going to
solid.
The...
Well, I think the Maze Runner will be another curious case because it's a male-led YA
well,
adaptation.
I think
Divergent will be interesting, but Maze Runner is, you know, kind of the white... Well, I guess you could also consider Ender's Game.
That's what I was going to bring up, but I think Ender's Game has had so much baggage. And it's not new. It had been around for so long, whereas I assume... I don't know. How long has Maze Runner been around? If only there were way to access loads of knowledge at your fingertips.
Some sort of internetworking.
Like a series
something.
Of tubes that you could just put together and glean information. The Maze Runner was published in October 2009. So it's new.
So there you go. Well, see, that's the interesting thing, too, with the YA series. Like, a lot of them have only been around since the 2000s at the latest. The ones that are being turned into franchises now.
Right. Mortal Instruments, I feel, is much older.
Like, oh, is it?
Yeah, I feel like that one, because there's, like, 5 books in that series already.
Well, I was going to compare them relative to, since we were talking about comic book superhero movies earlier. I mean,
quote, unquote,
had, like,
old
decades.
Is 2007, so not that old.
So there you go. So everything's between, like, 5 and 10 years old versus 50 to 60 years for superhero stuff. So.
And you know what that is. It's Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this is what Harry Potter wrought, is all these kind of, like, sci-fi or fantasy-ish. Harry, a mix of Harry Potter and Twilight. So everyone's I can write a story like that.
And it's, I think it, for me, at least for me, it causes me to start ignoring stuff. Like, I didn't, Vampire Academy, I honestly thought it was a TV show. And I saw a poster for it the other day, and I'm like, oh, it is, and a friend told me, it's like, it is a movie. And I looked at that trailer, and that trailer looks really good. It looks, like, really entertaining. You didn't like it?
The latest one.
Maybe it's a different one that I've seen, because you guys have been talking about that one more recently. But the ones that I've seen, especially in the theater, I'm just kind of like, all right.
Oh, yeah,
nothing
one,
really
the
happens
in
the trailer.
Well, this one came out like a couple days ago.
I haven't seen that one then.
And it's kind of, it looks kind of like a Heather's, like, Mean Girls.
And it's from the director, and they play it up as from the director of Mean Girls.
Yeah.
Okay.
It looks fun. It looks like it has a lot of comedy to it, because I've gotten to the point where I just write off anything vampire.
Right.
And this one looks like it has a fun spin on it that you haven't seen. And so, but already, it's like, I don't know how many other people have that snap reaction like I am, where it's like, fuck, vampires, who gives a shit? So tired.
Every trailer that comes out, too, whether it's vampires, witches, werewolves, whatever, everything is from the best-selling series. It's like, everything's a fucking best-selling series now. So what really, like, separates the cream of the crop? You know what I mean? Like, everything that's being made, obviously, they're not going to take a worst-selling series and be like, oh, let's make a feature franchise out of that. That's a fantastic idea. So everything that comes across is the best-selling series from this author you've never heard of.
But you could pick up the rights for so cheap if you picked up a worst-selling novel.
Well, but the crazy thing is that it's like, you can tell a best-selling first one, and then they'll pick up your rights, and now you have to crank the other ones out as they're making the movie, which was, I guess, kind of the case with Veronica Roth. Kind of the similar thing.
Or this guy named George R.R. Martin, who has got
it. That too.
No, Divergent's pretty new. She, like, I think it was during the editing of the first book that she, like, plotted out how the rest of the series would end and kind of knew that the series was coming. So she planned it as a trilogy.
Yeah, but to me, the fact that if the writing suffers because A, you're just not a strong writer and it's tough to conclude a series in a strong way, or B, because you have that pressure of like, oh, by the way, it's going to be a giant film franchise now too. So
yeah, I think there's some of that pressure.
Especially if you're a 24-year-old.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think when like the first book comes out and it's a thing and they're like, all right, I assume the book world works kind of similar to the movie world where it's like the publishing company is like, when's the next one coming? Because we're ready.
They'll sign you for like a multiple book deal now. That's like the major thing that they do because they don't want to invest all the – it's just like the movies. They don't want to invest the time in the marketing and the manpower in making your name big and getting your book published if you don't have at least two more planned. If you don't have at least a trilogy, it's really tough to break into that industry too, unless you're already somebody who makes their living off of writing just single, you know, one installment novels, or you have a character that can just be plugged into a hard-boiled crime series or a detective series forever, you know, the alphabet murders, things like that.
Yeah, and you wonder how much of the story suffers when you're having a stretch out story over multiple films. I think of John Green's The Fault in Our Stars, which is technically a YA novel, but it's a one-off, and it's a fantastic book, and it's
The Spectacular Now is technically a young adult.
Yeah,
novel.
And that's also right. And those are like really kind of neat books that aren't trying to be stretched out or anything.
The Perks of Being a Wallflower, right. Young adult novel, amazing drama. So we should expand that. I agree.
That's the thing when we say YA novels and especially the film franchises, most of them tend to be the ones that we think of tend to be the Twilight or the
Absolutely.
Harry Potter type that are more sort of action oriented. More flashy, more the blockbuster, less of the indie dramas.
Yeah, just as when we say comic book movies, we're really talking about superhero films rather than like American Splendor, something like that.
Yeah, yeah, or Super even, or something like that. Like, yeah, we're talking more of the big blockbuster type
well,
stuff.
Well, there's an entire section at Barnes & Noble for teen paranormal romance. Like, it's
exactly.
Not even YA is too large of a – there's such an influx of Twilight-esque books that it's
right.
You can fill up like two entire rows paranormal romance.
Oh, and back to your point of you were saying
which
like,
is amazing that those girls even go to bookstores anymore.
That anybody goes to bookstores
yeah.
anymore. But back to Adam's point that like Harry Potter and Twilight kind of kicked off this, oh, I can write this too, trend that everybody's gotten into. Like if you look at some of the major books that are coming out, most of them started as a fan fiction for another series. So they started mm-hmm. writing as fan fiction. They gained a following on online because people like their stuff, and then they were like, oh, I'll just change the names and the places, and now it's a brand new book series. Like
yeah,
50 Mortal Shades of Grey.
Yeah, 50 Shades of Grey, Mortal Instruments, yep. Those are both fan fiction.
Exactly. So it's just kind of a weird culture that's just, it's kind of this odd machine that's turning these things out. It's very, very strange.
Oh, fan fiction.
Hey, man, if it, you know.
If the names have been changed to protect the author from copyright infringement, go for
that's
it.
That's pretty much what it is, and they make millions off of it, so good for them, question mark.
I think we should start a series called Good For Them, question mark.
I'm down.
Let's start
My
that
My biggest
up.
Question mark, since we're talking about YA series, now this isn't female-fronted, but Percy Jackson, which was kind of forgotten that they even produced the sequel.
And I liked the sequel, kind of.
I didn't even get to see it, and I liked the books. I read all the books. Now, those are skewed for kind of a younger audience.
Oh, yeah, this is definitely like, the second movie is definitely like a PG film.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. But it did fairly well worldwide, so, I mean, who knows? Maybe they'll continue with that, too. He's got a few more books, and then he split off into a couple other different complete series, so... He's got
like
a lot.
James Patterson of the kids' fantasy book world.
He does a great job at just taking existing mythologies and kind of spinning them into a way that's relatable for younger readers and makes them more interested in that mythology itself. He's done a good job with that, and he's a pretty good writer too. So,
that's the bonus. Yeah, that's the bonus now. And if they're a good writer, nice, good stuff too.
Well, I think that's. I was just trying to illustrate the difference between some like a fairly young female writer who comes out and has a best-selling book, may or may not be based on her fan fiction cred, and then it explodes, and then they're like, by the way, write four more books real fast. Whereas somebody like Rick Riordan has already had his series out for a number of years. He's split onto a bunch of other things, and he's not really tied into the movies all that much because he did not like the experience on the first one. So as far as I know, he has very, very little to do with it. But I think that's kind of the old guard way of doing things. Like even J.K. Rowling, I guess she's going to be writing the screenplays for her new adaptations that are coming out?
Yeah, she's
at least co-writing
that, okay, for that new. I mean, she's solely writing the at least the.
And she gets to do it on her own pace.
Yeah, she's more than earned.
Yeah, what like, are you going to say to her?
Yeah, like, I paid for half of your studio, so
yeah, pretty much.
Let me do what I want when I want.
I have more money than the Queen of England. You'll get it when it's goddamn ready.
And what and what's so fucking great about that is she gives it all away to charity. Like, she dropped off the billionaires list last year because she gave so much to charity, which I think is fantastic.
It is fantastic.
When you watch any of her interviews and stuff, she's like, I'm not going to tell you how much I have, but she's like, more than I could even imagine what to do with. And for somebody who imagined the world of Harry Potter to say that she can't even imagine spending all that.
I mean, really, my first instinct would be, I'm going to build a real Hogwarts. But no one else can come to it.
Yeah.
I'm going to build a castle with a moat and a drawbridge.
Yeah, and she could if she wanted to.
Yeah, at least one.
Right. Well, the second one, I mean, because that already kind of exists in England, because they kept the Harry Potter studio, because they knew they'd need it for so long that they built it out of real things, like they built it out of stone.
They're like, we've got all these actual castles, but eh, fuck it, we'll just make another one. It'll be fine.
You find her just living at Universal Studios Orlando and, like, that Hogwarts castle.
I live in Diagon Alley.
She's just writing in the Three Broomsticks every day. She's just writing out the screenplay with a butterbeer in her hand.
Joe, you're in Florida.
No, this is Hogwarts.
No, there's one in London. There's the real one in London.
Yeah,
which is much nicer, and that's what I'm saying. She should go to the actual one, which is near where she actually lives. That probably, in this whole mythical scenario we're creaming up for J.K. Rowling, oh my god, have we lost the thread of this conversation.
No, those are future adaptations that I'm still looking forward to, even though they're based on such odd kind of spin-offs from her own series. They're basically just like, she had all this encyclopedic knowledge and then she was just like, meh, I'm just gonna put it down.
I'm so excited for that, because one of the things I like about Harry Potter is the world.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I don't care if Harry, in fact, I don't want Harry Potter to come back, not because I don't like him, but his character story is complete. So, and when she said she's writing a Harry Potter encyclopedia, I'm like, that's fantastic.
Yeah,
because
great.
there's so much history there. There's so much cool stuff that one of the reasons I like rereading the books is I just like being in that world again. So the fact that she's writing a movie that takes place 70 years before in a different part of the world, like, go for it. I'll be happy to see it. And also, she can't ruin Harry Potter. That's even the other thing. She can't touch that mythology now. So those stories will keep standing. So there's no risk there.
Yeah, she's not going to make prequels that go into Harry's story and, like, the wild ride of Voldemort before he gets killed.
Voldemort's wild ride now at Universal Studios.
That's what I call that final scene between him and Harry. That's the only thing I didn't like about the last movie. But that's a very strong aside. Yeah, I'm anxious to revisit that world, and that's something I look forward to seeing. And woe betide any other franchise that runs into their same release date and schedule in the future.
Justice League.
It'll be opposite the Avengers 5.
Avengers 5. I was about to say Justice League, and that's dumb because Warner Brothers isn't going to cannibalize their own movie.
Yeah. I would hope not.
I would like if she's like, I got it ready, and they're like, let's put it in 2015. No! When I found out they were putting Mad Max in 2015.
Yeah, it's like, good luck, guys.
Good luck, yeah. Well, it's okay, we're coming out in May. Good luck, guys. So, oh, God.
And then the final Hunger Games, so.
Yeah, the final one. Oh, goodness. But to me, it's like the success of the final one, to bring this all back around, is based on how the first Mockingjay, because as we've said, Mockingjay is not a good story, and that's when directors get caught in how do we adapt this, because Twilight just had to be faithful, and the best part of the entire Twilight saga was the 10 minutes where they decided, let's not be faithful and let's just go and kill everyone and just go nuts. And
it was genuinely fantastic. It was so good.
It is.
Thank you guys for telling me to at least watch that scene, which I found later, and I thought that was amazing.
Oh, great. Oh, and even greater is going with a bunch of people. I went to the midnight with a bunch of friends, and the girls were literally crying.
I know. I saw it at a screening, and they were all so shocked. And we were all so into it. For 10 beautiful minutes, it all came together in a masterful way. And then it was all a dream.
What's his name's head off, and, like, everyone's just...
Carlisle. Yeah, Carlisle's head pops off. And that's the other thing. It's a PG-13, so it's like, it's almost like World's End. Everyone's just, twist the melon, man.
Yeah,
right.
The sound is like porcelain, like, breaking is like the sound when you pop their heads off or, like, the necks. It's so great.
It really is.
Those movies, going to those movies, like, that is the... those are the definition of fan service. Like, the credits for Breaking Dawn Part 2 are every single character that has been in the movies, no matter how large or small, like a montage of their faces. And that is not something you do in movies. Like,
well, didn't they do that at the end of Return of the King?
I don't know.
They think they did that in the end credits. I think Sean Bean has, he's in the end credits, even though he's not in the movie.
I don't remember that. Well, this was like even like every single minor character from all Twilight movies is like, it's like a montage of like them, like, oh, and remember this one and remember this one. And it's like that, that is a movie franchise that was financed by Summit solely to make fans of the book happy, which is
fine. And there were enough fans. See, that's something else to consider. There, it seems like there weren't enough Mortal Instruments fans, or at least not enough excited ones.
No.
To come out and support that film. So it's a matter of how big is a fan base to really support something. Because, right, as Dave says, like, they're all best-selling novels.
Exactly.
Yes. It's, and they're crazy. Like, to the point of where they have to halt production of the Mortal Instruments sequel after the first one tanks at the box office.
Is this a good
idea? Starting out a production now or something?
Yeah. Go for it, Screen Gems.
It's independently financed. It's not Screen Gems.
Oh, it isn't anymore. Oh, good luck, whoever dumped
Screen Gems didn't even do the first movie. It's independently financed by some other.
Oh, so they distribute it, though. To me, the Screen Gems logo is a sign of danger.
Yes.
It really is.
It's like a caution.
That and Original Film, which is Neil Moritz's company. And the only good thing they've done is 21 Jump Street. And by the sound of it, 22 Jump Street. So,
well, and I know based on Divergent that they, like, you know, Summit is behind it, and Summit just dealt with, you know, Summit and Lionsgate both. It's these two companies are behind Divergent with Twilight and Hunger Games, and you know, the studio told me I could like tell everyone that, you know, I visited the set and talked to like the producer, and he said that like all of the actors went through like training, like the Summit people sat down with them and like have been training them and like how to deal with the fans and how to deal with like the promo stuff. And it's like, well, what if this is all for naught? Like, what if Lionsgate Summit has the first like whiff? Because this would be, if I'm not mistaken, this is their first, you know, attempt at another YA franchise. It's kind of like Marvel, you know.
Well, I mean, they also did Summit did Ender's Game, but again, there's a lot of baggage attached to that.
Yeah,
that's true. But I feel like Divergent is very much in the same realm with Hunger Games, Twilight.
It is.
Like, this is their third one. They're kind of venturing outside of.
Well, and they set it to a March release date, which is where the first Hunger Games is. They're trying to put it in that mold of we know that a young adult film can be successful in this month, assuming we can get the fans to come out and that there's crossover appeal.
Do we know who's coming back as far as director, screenwriter for the last two series? Is Lawrence attached for the last two?
Yeah, he's in it till the end.
Do we know the screenwriters?
That.
Did we actually break that? I remember we posted it. I know we broke it. That's cool. Do we know the screenwriters? Is it Beaufoy and...
No, it's Danny Strong. Danny Strong is doing both of them. Because the overlap was such that like they were doing prep
everything
on
else.
Mockingjay while they were finishing up Catching Fire. But it was Beaufoy and Michael Arndt did Catching Fire, and but Michael Arndt used a pseudonym, which apparently he uses when he does kind of like rewrite work that's not fully his, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. Well, but Danny Strong's a good writer, so
yeah, he should be okay. I like the adaptation of the last of Catching Fire, so I was hoping that they would kind of be around or at least do consulting work to kind of keep a through line. But okay, Danny Strong, we'll see.
I mean, there's nothing that says Beaufoy and Arndt can't be. We can't pick up a telephone and say, "Hey, what's up?"
Yeah,
what's up, Danny Strong? Yeah. So I don't know. I liked what they did with this movie. I was impressed. I thought it was
Danny Strong came on so early, so cool.
Just to finish that thought, I feel like this was an improvement on both the source material and its predecessor in the film world. So I really think they need a strong showing, no pun intended with Danny's name, but they need a strong showing for adaptation of the last book, especially because they got two things working against them. They're splitting it into two movies, and it's the weakest of the three. So that's the only thing that I'm kind of concerned about going forward.
And to me, that's go ahead, Adam.
I was going to say, there is a clear splitting point in Mockingjay, which I think we all kind of know where that will be. And I did love how they ended Catching Fire on a cliffhanger. I thought that was great. Like the way
it's a great shot, too.
Oh, it's fantastic. And that's what got me – that's what I am genuinely excited for Mockingjay, which I would say that I would be, because I was just kind of dreading, like, oh, God. like especially with Lawrence on board directing. But I think that he's got a strong handle on it. I did kind of, I know I'm in the minority on this. I did miss Gary Ross's kind of verite camera style from the first movie.
You're not in the minority. I liked it too. I mean, mm-hmm. I thought that was one of the, that's one of the things I liked most about the first film. It had a very folksy feel to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was like, what's with all these wide shots? I was like, I can see the whole set. What's going on?
Yeah, I think you went to show it off.
And I also
there was some pretty nice sets. Yeah.
And I didn't love the score, which I think was the same person. It felt so traditional compared to I really liked the kind of strangeness of the music in the first movie. I know James Newton Howard did Catching Fire. Did he do the first movie? I know Danny Elfman was originally working on it with T-Bone Burnett for the first movie.
Yeah, yeah, T-Bone Burnett wasn't working on Catching Fire because he was doing Inside Llewyn Davis.
Right.
Yeah. James Newton Howard, he was the composer of both of them. So,
well, and I guess it was T-Bone's influence then that really helped.
Yeah.
Flavor of T-Bone.
Because it was kind of like when it got to like the kissy scenes, it felt very kind of traditional, and I was kind of put off by that. But overall, I thought it was really a really strong adaptation.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Okay, then.
Go check it out if you haven't yet.
I think a lot of people have, but go check it out if you haven't.
Well, see it again anyway.
See it again. It's great.
For Thanksgiving. Yeah.
Yeah, I might actually end up seeing it again. I'm not, like, super crazy about it, but...
that's one I can wait till it comes out, but...
if my brother hasn't seen it and if my mom is willing to see it, yeah. Someone has to go see a Thanksgiving film. That being said, I'm hearing Frozen...
Homefront.
I've only heard great things about Frozen, and I'm seeing that tomorrow, so I'm excited. Nice.
Did either of you see Hunger Games in IMAX? I was interested to see how that.
No,
they shot all of the arena scenes in IMAX.
I kind of wish I had, but they didn't screen it for us in IMAX. So.
Yeah, I didn't either. I think that would be interesting because I think Jermaine clocked it at like 50, 40 minutes of IMAX.
I think once they enter the arena, it's all IMAX.
Yeah, it's all IMAX. I said somebody was tweeting earlier today that they were glad they kept the IMAX perspective or whatever their word was for the whole thing, basically. Yeah.
Interesting. So that's I would cool. like to see that. Yeah. Also, Lionsgate finally gave them a budget to do effects because the effects in the first one were so terrible. And I was like, people were like saying Gary, like it was Gary Ross's fault. I was like, they didn't give him any money because this was an untested property.
Right.
Like, and of this course wasn't they're going to give the second one a ton.
And this wasn't really effects heavy. I can't think of anything.
Well, like the sets, like a lot of stuff in the Capitol is digitally created, and
a lot of them were pretty practical though. A lot of the stuff was in Atlanta, and then obviously in Hawaii. So.
Atlanta's all fake. It's a giant green screen town.
That's all it is. I look outside my window; it's all green here.
Yeah,
that explains it.
And I'm sure Mockingjay will cost even more. And I mean, the third film based on this one will. Well, that's the thing, Adam. Will this have they hit a ceiling on the Hunger Games?
Like box office? Or like
a box office.
Oh, box office wise. That's what I think is so interesting. I don't know. I think that's really interesting that this movie made nearly the same amount as the first one, which is not what you generally expect.
Because Twilight hit a ceiling.
I'm wondering if Jennifer Lawrence's character, if her like arc is going to kind of keep going up, and maybe that'll encourage more people to check her out in the Hunger Games series if they haven't. I don't know if that's going to add to it or not. You know, like people want to check out Katniss, but will they also want to check out Jennifer Lawrence when it comes to this time next year? Like, will those things kind of converge together and make a stronger showing? I don't know. That's an interesting thing to check out.
Well, I think she already has an Oscar under her belt.
Right.
So I think people are now aware of Jennifer Lawrence. I stick to the fact that I don't think they're really movie stars anymore.
Right.
And so people are showing up for Katniss, the challenge of Jennifer Lawrence is, can she open a film that isn't Hunger Games?
Yes.
And
yes.
That it completely rests on her shoulders. Like American Hustle doesn't rest on her.
Right. It's all ensemble stuff. Yeah.
Exactly.
She doesn't have another one because she's in the middle. They started shooting Mockingjay a month ago. So she's got that two films back to back to do. So she won't be like available for a lead until next year. And I know she's planning on teaming up with Carrie Ross again. But, you know, I think if by the second movie, like I think that it has hit a ceiling because if people aren't checking in by the second movie, then it's not going to, like, by the third movie, it's not going to be that much higher than the second, it kind of feels like. I think I feel like all the people that were interested in Hunger Games will have seen the second movie. But again, maybe people are waiting for Thanksgiving. Maybe they're holding out for that.
Indeed. You guys have anything more to say on the young adult craze? Or do you guys want to move on to recommendations?
I think my fire is extinguished on this one. Terrible.
I have a friend who's doing a double feature of Catching Fire and Frozen.
Womp womp.
Womp womp. All right, Dave, what do you got for us in recommendations?
Oh, Lord. This is going to be kind of a, this is going to be more of a book recommendation than a movie.
We don't read here, Dave.
I was scouring my brain to be like, oh, what's a YA adaptation that was good but people don't know about? Well, guess what? There aren't any. So I'm going to go back to 2006 and pull out a pretty crappy adaptation of a pretty decent book, Aragon. 2006 is Aragon.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's a rough watch, people. It's a rough watch.
You couldn't
watch
even go with Inkheart. Inkheart is slightly better than Aragon.
If you're feeling real down, don't watch it because I worry about you. But if you want to pick up the book, however, that's actually pretty well done. It was a young kid that started this series as kind of like his own sort of mythological swords and sorcery, dragons kind of series. And it did pretty well for the first couple of books. It, again, weakened towards the end. I don't know if it's because he was worried about movie stuff or if he just kind of ran out of steam. It's unfortunate because it had a pretty strong idea in the book itself. It basically involved a world where magic was kind of kept to only certain people who had this specific training for it, and it was tied into the existence of dragons. And in this world, most of the dragons, pretty much all the dragons that people knew about, had been killed, obliterated, destroyed. All the eggs, all the different lineages, everything was destroyed. Well, it's this young sort of farm boy. It's the kind of typical story of like a rags to riches kind of pauper to hero kind of tale. He basically becomes a dragon rider at some point. So that grants him these magical powers that he has to kind of hone and learn how to control. And there are some costs to using this magic that are associated with it. So it's not just casting a spell and everything's done. You know, you can't just move a mountain and then not pay some sort of toll for that. So I thought that was an interesting idea that's in a lot of fantasy lore and a lot of fantasy writing, but you don't really see that in movies too much. So anyway, strong start to the series, and then they really cocked up the movie adaptation, and they had a fairly strong cast too. I mean, Jeremy Irons was in it, Robert Carlyle, who's doing fairly well on TV right now, John Malkovich was in it, who he's not my favorite of individuals, but he has a good following. A fairly strong cast, and it did not come together. It was a really, really poor adaptation. So again, this is not a recommendation of the movie, unless you hate yourself, but it is a recommendation of the book. Pick it up, check it out, because you may not have heard of it, because it's now 7 years old, at least. The movie's 7 years old. So it's Christopher Paolini is the author, and he wrote a book called Aragon, which is like dragon, but with an E instead of a D. Pretty easy.
Yeah, so if you want to read a fucking book, check out Aragon. All right, Adam, what do you got for us movie watchers?
I am actually, I was kind of torn on recommendations, so I will say that Cary Fukunaga's Jane Eyre is very much well worth watching, but I am actually going to recommend Mark Romanek's Never Let Me Go, which is based on the Kazuo Ishiguro novel of the same name. Novel came out in 2005. It's a British dystopian sci-fi drama is how it would be classified, and it's got a fantastic cast led by Andrew Garfield, Carey Mulligan, and Keira Knightley, and it's British dystopian sci-fi in every sense of the word. It is a downer, not, you know, it doesn't try to kind of smooth edges or anything. It's told in a frame story, and I don't want to give any kind of the turns of the story away, but I will say it takes place in a world where there are kind of doubles of people who can act as organ donors. I know it sounds a little bit like Michael Bay's The Island, but it's a million times better, or kind of like Logan's Run. But it's a human story. It focuses on these three young students who grew up together, Carey Mulligan, Andrew Garfield, and Keira Knightley. And there's a love story in it. Andrew Garfield's character and Keira Knightley's character kind of get together, but it's kind of clear that Carey Mulligan's character and Andrew Garfield's character are kind of more meant for each other. But it raises a lot of really good questions. It's very much a very strong sci-fi film in that way. But it's emotional. It's really thought-provoking. And it just provides this great atmosphere and mood throughout the entire film. And again, I don't want to give away any of the turns or anything, but I would just say I would highly recommend you kind of just go in and watch it and just kind of experience it from beginning to end. But it was a sadly overlooked film. It came out in 2010, so not a ton of people saw it. So I would very much recommend you watch that. And then from a YA standpoint, book-wise, since Dave recommended a book, I'm going to recommend John Green's Fault in Our Stars, which is coming for the next year, and it's fantastic. It's this really kind of emotional, moving story. I know it's filed under YA, but it's really, really great. It's one of the best books I've read over the past few years, so I would highly encourage you to seek it out before the movie comes out. Shailene Woodley stars in it. It's about two young cancer-stricken patients who meet up in a support group. So it's a great read if you're looking for something to read.
Okay, then. I will recommend Sympathy for Lady Vengeance. Last week I recommended Old Boy, which is the second film in Park Chan-wook's Vengeance trilogy. The first one is Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, then Old Boy, then Sympathy for Lady Vengeance. They all come at the theme of revenge from different places. Sympathy for Lady Vengeance, they're all kind of weird movies, but Lady Vengeance is very strange. It, from a plot perspective, it's a woman who's basically been framed for murder. She kind of had some participation in it, but not to the extent where she was the one who's supposed to go to prison. The person she was working with should have gone. But in prison, she builds up a nice reputation. She picks up the nickname Kind-Hearted, and I'm Jim Ja. The film's South Korean, so I'm going to butcher these names. But she is very nice to everyone. She ingratiates herself with the inmates. And then she gets out, and now she has all these favors, and she sort of turns to sort of, arguably, you know, is this her true nature? Because she has a daughter that she lost, as she believes is dead, but has actually been kidnapped / adopted by a family in Australia. That the daughter was taken from her. She thinks the daughter is dead. And eventually it starts morphing into a story where the person that she went to jail for, it's not that she's out to get him because of that, but it's that she starts learning things about him that are so much worse than what she thought. And the film is, whereas Old Boy is, there's more to one perspective than revenge, Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance is how far is too far for the cost of it. But it frames in this really weird, sometimes surreal story that's still captivating. It has a gorgeous score, much like Old Boy. And I'm really on board with Park Chan-wook's visual style. If you didn't see Stoker, that's definitely worth checking out. If you want to sort of maybe ease in to his movies, because Lady Vengeance isn't the place to start, but it isn't. Old Boy would be a better place to start, and that's now on Netflix Instant, so yeah, you can see that. And it's subtitled, so
Stoker's on Instant as well.
Exactly. Oh, Stoker? They added Stoker?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, so you can start getting into Park Chan-wook. Don't start with Lady Vengeance, but keep it in mind. So that's my recommendation. Next week, I don't know if we'll be on or not, because it's the fucking holidays, and I don't know. But, as for me, I have no YA books to recommend, because I'm a fucking adult. That's right. And I don't believe in reading. It's for squares.
It's not fair.
It isn't fair. Now, if you want a book recommendation, read Slow Getting Up. If you're watching football, here, you're going to watch football on Thanksgiving, read Slow Getting Up, which is about Nate Jackson in his life as in the NFL. He was not a famous player. He was but he went through all the positions. He went to NFL Europe. He was on the practice squad. He did everything, and it's an insider's account of what it's really like being in the NFL, and it's fascinating and it's well written. His brain
goes
not
any given Sunday.
Any given Sunday, I can do without that movie. I know some people love Any Given Sunday. I can do without that movie. This is a good book. This was a page turner. So apparently we're recommending books now. I don't know why I just so come off as
people encouraging literacy.
We're gonna turn into Reading Rainbow.
I'm okay with that too.
I don't know. For the people who don't know, I'm not seriously against books. I like reading.
Actually illiterate here at Collider. I'm not sure if you're aware.
Actually, I feel sometimes I am illiterate. I have so many typos in my writing, and just it's awful. I'm amazed that I can string a sentence together. Okay, so if you want to keep up with this podcast full of literate gentlemen, you can follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Where can we, Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Dave?
at Dr. Claw MD.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a good Thanksgiving, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
May the odds be ever in your favor.
Go read.
Go read.
Did it.